From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the breakdown in the Middle East peace process and what it means for the future of the region. Israelis and Palestinians have different interpretations of what went wrong. We'll talk to Palestinian journalist Dawood Kutab, director of the Institute of Modern Media at Al-Quds University in Jerusalem, and Israeli journalist David Horovitz, editor of the news magazine The Jerusalem Report. What would it take to resume negotiations? We'll ask Hanan Ashrawi, the former official spokesperson of the Palestinian delegation to the Middle East peace process, and Uri Sevier, Israel's representative to the secret Oslo peace talks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The House has approved a $240 billion tax cut package, including Medicare money for hospitals and a minimum wage increase. The White House says President Clinton will veto the measure. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The measure would raise the minimum wage by $1 over 2 years, give small businesses tax breaks to offset the costs of the wage hike, and increase the limit for contributions to individual retirement accounts. The bill also contains tax breaks to encourage development in poor communities and to help build new classrooms. House Speaker Dennis Hastert made a rare floor speech to urge lawmakers approve the package.
It's time for this body to quit the quibbling, to come together, and pass good legislation.
But President Clinton says most of the $30 billion in new Medicare funding will help HMOs, not hospitals, and the margin of passage in the House is not enough to overturn the threatened veto. Brian Naylor, NPR News, the Capitol.
Nonpartisan financial experts said today that both major party presidential candidates are offering faulty proposals to reform Social Security and Medicare. The American Academy of Actuaries said George W. Bush and Al Gore have offered plans that are incomplete, at times internally inconsistent, and potentially misleading. The report faulted Bush's plan to allow workers to put a portion of their payroll taxes in individual retirement accounts, saying it would make it impossible to pay off the national debt by 2016, as Bush has promised. The Academy said Gore's promise to protect Medicare in an imaginary lockbox is a political promise rather than sound policy. It said the next president will have to use some combination of new taxes, deficits, budget cuts, or reduced spending on other programs to protect Medicare. With the presidential election less than 2 weeks away, the candidates are stumping through so-called battleground states. GOP vice presidential candidate Dick Cheney spent this afternoon in Columbus, Ohio. Fonda Bach reports from member station WOSU.
Speaking to a crowd of about 300 at a steel manufacturing plant, Cheney first took a few swipes at Al Gore. He then reiterated the GOP stand on tax cuts, Social Security, education, and the military that have been played throughout this campaign. The vice presidential candidate wrapped up the rally by asking the crowd for their votes.
Not only do we need your vote, we need you to talk to your friends and neighbors and family members. Make sure all of them vote. Get them all out there on Election Day. Ohio is a very important state. It's one of a handful of states that's going to determine the outcome of this election. If we win Ohio, we're going to win on November 7th.
The latest Buckeye State poll released this week shows Gore with a slight edge over Bush in Ohio. No Republican has ever won the presidency without carrying the Buckeye State. For NPR News, I'm Fonda Bach in Columbus, Ohio.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 53 points to close at 10,380. This is NPR News. Hospital officials in New York say former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger is recovering from what doctors called a limited heart attack. A spokeswoman at the New York Weill Cornell Medical Center said the 77-year-old Nobel Peace Laureate is doing well, but is expected to remain in the hospital for a few days. If you weren't lined up last night for the midnight launch of PlayStation 2, Sony's new video game console, it could be months before you can get your hands on one. NPR's Elaine Corey has more.
Sony had only 500,000 PlayStation 2 units available for all of North America. Scuffles broke out at several retail stores as hundreds of people vied for very limited supplies of the $299 console. Jim Silver, publisher of The Toy Book, says each new gaming system creates a sensation, but with the PlayStation 2, it's warranted.
It is the best state-of-the-art video game system that has ever hit the country. This is a system that has unbelievable graphics, a 300 megahertz processor.
In fact, says Silver, with its ability to play DVD movies and connect to the internet, Sony has positioned the PlayStation 2 as an entire interactive entertainment center in a box. Elaine Corey, NPR News, San Francisco.
A fire at a plastics factory in Richmond, California forced the closing of 10 schools in nearby communities and the evacuation of a Ford Motor Company plant. Officials say the fire left one worker at the plant dead and four injured. Four firefighters have been treated for smoke inhalation at nearby hospitals. The fire is now under control and the evacuation order has been lifted. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Now that the Middle East peace process has broken down, Palestinians and Israelis are not only disagreeing about the injustices of the past and what should happen in the future, they disagree about why the peace fell apart. Later, we'll talk with two people who participated in peace talks, Palestinian Hanan Ashrawi and Israeli Uri Sevier, and ask them what it would take to resume negotiations. We'll start by examining what went wrong. In a few minutes, we'll talk with Israeli journalist David Horovitz. My first guest is Palestinian journalist Daoud Kutab. He's the director of the Institute of Modern Media at Al-Quds University in Jerusalem, and he directs an educational TV station. He's the co-executive producer of an Israeli-Palestinian version of Sesame Street and the former managing editor of an English-language weekly. Israelis have accused Arafat of not attempting to stop Palestinian violence. Palestinians say the Israeli army has overreacted in its use of force. I ask Kutab what he thinks.
Well, I think we have two problems here. We have a problem which most people don't understand, is that Palestinians are rebelling, are revolting against a foreign military occupation on their own land. So the protests are taking place in the Palestinian areas, not in Israel, and they're against the Israeli occupying army, not against the State of Israel. And by international law, people have a right to rebel and to resist occupation. Now, for 7 years, Palestinians have been promised to ask to keep quiet, to keep their heads low, because there is a peace process. They have seen no concrete result of the peace process. Their economic situation hasn't improved. Their freedom of movement hasn't changed. And what was offered, finally, in a permanent status agreement was not up to the standards or expectations of Palestinians. So there is frustration. On the other hand, when Palestinians protested with stones and threw empty bottles and so on, Israel reacted very violently, which caused the cycle of violence to be kicked up more, and every time Palestinians were killed on their own land, defending their own land, there was more protest, and the protest caused more killings, and the cycle of violence intensified. So the Israelis never used batons, they never used shields, they never used the normal gear that most people do to kind of to quell the protest. Instead, they used live ammunition, rubber-coated metal bullets, and later they started shelling and using helicopters and tanks to shell civilian populations. So it's not just me, but the Security Council, the European Union, and Amnesty International have all said that Israel has used excessive force in trying to respond to the Palestinian protests.
Do you know any of the young people who have been throwing rocks at the Israeli military?
I did a profile a while back. It's called The Profile of a Palestinian Stone Thrower. You know, they are young people who have basically been born in times of occupation. And these guys today, you know, some of them were young kids when the first Intifada began. So they are people who, like all young people, have lots of hopes in their mind, but they have been living, some of them, since they were born. They haven't been able to leave their own town because of the closures, because of the bans on movement. And they have lots of pent-up anger and frustration. And it all comes out in these protests. And things get worse when some of their buddies get killed or injured, and they get even more angry. So the frustration is the big problem here, the lack of feeling that the peace process is going to produce any concrete results. They are unable to really fathom the way the Israelis are humiliating the Palestinians. And again, the biggest problem is the continued killings, because when one is killed, there is a funeral for him, and there is, you know, more anger, and the cycle gets worse and worse.
You were once detained at the Palestinian Authority police station that was bombed by the Israelis after the murder of two Israeli soldiers. What were you detained for?
I run an educational television station which was broadcasting live sessions of the Palestinian Legislative Council. And there were some very hotly debated sessions dealing with corruption in the Palestinian Authority. And the broadcast of these sessions displeased some people in the Palestinian Authority, and they held me for 7 days, and afterwards I was released without being charged or even questioned about it. That's what happened.
How did that affect your feelings about the Palestinian Authority's approach
I'm not naive in considering the Palestinian Authority to be dressed in white and, you know, angels from heaven. I do understand that they have different priorities than I have. Their priority, as they stated, is more the political process and the independence. And they feel that issues of democracy should really take second fiddle. At the time, I felt that that was not my priorities, and I felt that we needed to really build the proper foundations for a Palestinian state, and therefore there had to be more democratic and more free, and that's why we did what we did, and we continue to do what we did even after I was released. Until this day, we continue to broadcast sessions of the Palestinian Legislative Council. We hold very hotly debated topics in roundtable programs, and we allow callers to call in, and they say often many things that are not very pleasing to the Palestinian Authority. So it's a commitment that I'm strongly holding on to and I believe in. And in the same tone, I believe very much in the right of Palestinians to have an independent state. So I would say at this very moment, the issue of the conflict with Israelis is taking priorities, but our commitment hasn't wavered, and we continue to believe in the fact that we need the rule of law and democracy and separation of powers.
You're the co-producer of a Palestinian-Israeli version of Sesame Street. What's the idea behind this show?
Again, the show that we produced really took off after the beginning of the peace process, and our aim was and still is to really plant with children the concepts of tolerance and mutual respect, and to stop the dehumanizing process that exists today between Palestinian children towards Israelis and vice versa. And so we try to present to our children a different version of what Israelis are like, and also in Israel to show them Palestinians different than what their stereotype is. And we ran a season of shows, and they were successful in the sense that studies showed that they did help in starting to change perceptions. The road was and still is very long, and unfortunately the power of guns and violence speak much louder than the movements of puppets on television. And so I'm really concerned that really we cannot do that type of a programming with violence going on outside, because that really drowns whatever words and sounds of peace there are.
So the program is still going on now?
Well, we shot and broadcast a season. In fact, this week we were supposed to start negotiating another season with Jordanians and Israelis, but the virus has postponed all our meetings. So, yes, we did run a session, and we basically ran and filmed it and broadcast it, and we were hoping to do a new season.
You teach at a Palestinian university, Al-Quds University in East Jerusalem. Would you give us a sense of what kinds of discussions and debates are going on among your students now?
Unfortunately, the school year has never gone off to start. It hasn't started yet. We were supposed to start, the conflict, the protest, and the most important, the Israeli closures of the areas has forbidden students and teachers from entering. So we are really not able to conduct education. It's something that I think many of your viewers and listeners don't understand, is that we our whole life is taken upside down. People cannot go to work. People cannot come to university. Every day this protest continues. It's not very pleasant. It's very, very difficult. But the frustration is so high, and the feeling of helplessness is so high that people just say, you know, forget it. Let's all go out and protest, because they're not allowing us to go and move and to conduct normal life. So there is really no more in the last month or so. Normal life hasn't existed.
How has your life been changed by the clashes between Israelis and Palestinians?
My life is changed for years, but mostly I'm fighting with my wife all the time, because she's afraid for me, and I have to balance between her concerns and my responsibilities, and I'm also concerned about my staff and the people who go out and film, and I'm worried about, you know, hearing one day that one of my camera people get killed or something. So it's quite difficult position, being an employer and being a husband and a father, because you have so much responsibilities.
Now, the TV station that you run is a university-based station, a student station?
Yes, it's an educational TV station from the university.
And is it operating now, or is it shut down?
It is operating. It hasn't been shut down.
What kind of program are you carrying?
We have actually changed a lot of our programming, as you can imagine. But two things that we've really tried to concentrate on very lately, which is to really do a lot more first aid training, because people who are being injured sometimes get killed because of the way that they are being kind of carried and dealt with on the spot. And we're doing now a lot more psychological programs for children, because there is a lot of trauma among our children when their homes are being shelled or when they're hearing gunfire. So we'll bring psychologists and so on to answer questions of parents, and trying to put people at ease, or try to at least let them speak their mind, so that they don't, because it's very, very difficult. The emotional status of adults and children, it's really scary, and we've tried to help with that by doing programs with experts who can kind of explain to parents on how to deal with such cases.
Would you like to see Palestinians and Israelis go back to the negotiating table and work on a peace agreement again?
I think every sane Palestinian and Israeli want negotiations to take place. The shooting and bombings and stone throwing and being killed is certainly not something that anybody wishes. But I do wish that when the negotiations return, they are returned on the basis of attempting to find realistic solutions, respecting each other, and not trying to use the weight of power as the basic rule. And instead of might being right, we hope that right becomes might. And we have been humiliated so much in the negotiations, because Israelis basically say, we are negotiating with each other. And they come to the table and basically make an offer, and it's a take it or leave it offer. They don't really negotiate in good faith in the sense that they give and take. They only come and they say, this is the best we can give you, and we are the powerful side, and you better take it or else, you know, you'll continue to be under occupation. And there is enough pride in Palestinians to say sometimes no. And that really angers Israelis. They say that Palestinians are not being understanding of Israeli generosity. It's just this returning land that was taken by force in an illegal way is a kind of a charity to the Palestinians. So I think the perceptions, the way negotiations have taken place has to change, and I think we really need to have much more respect of each other for the negotiations to work.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Daoud Kutab directs the Institute of Modern Media at Al-Quds University in Jerusalem. He spoke to us from Amman, Jordan. Coming up, Israeli journalist David Horovitz, editor of the Jerusalem Report. This is Fresh Air. My guest David Horovitz is the editor of the Israeli news magazine, The Jerusalem Report. He's lived in Israel since emigrating from England in 1983. In his new book, A Little Too Close to God, he writes about what he describes as the thrills and panic of a life in Israel. The panic aspect has been emphasized by the collapse of the peace process, a process which he has supported. He's currently visiting the United States. I asked Horovitz for his interpretation of why the peace fell apart.
I have to say that I'm amazed by the number of people who are willing to speak in certainties and have those certainties sort of overturned a couple of days later. And I think it's foolish to try and draw firm conclusions. But the sense on the Israeli side is that with all the Palestinian claims of exaggerated Israeli response and the allegation that this was some kind of Machiavellian exit strategy by Israel, it really does seem as though it was Yasser Arafat who basically wimped out, who had spent all these years telling his people that they were going to get everything that they were aspiring to, and then when he was presented with an opportunity for a compromise that I think both sides would have been rather unhappy with, but I think both sides could have lived with, he felt unable to do it. I assume he thought that people would kill him, but he was the guy who was always talking about the peace of the braves, as he put it. Yitzhak Rabin was murdered by his own people for doing something that some on the far right of Israeli politics thought was unthinkable. And maybe Yasser Arafat would have been putting his life at stake, but he would have been getting a state in partnership with Israel on almost all of the territory that the Palestinians had sought from a prime minister who was offering to share Jerusalem with him. So I think the Israelis really cannot be faulted for what they were offering. And it does seem to me as though for Yasser Arafat this has been a way out.
Let's look at some of the alternative political scenarios now in Israel. Barak is considering trying to form a coalition government with Ariel Sharon. Sharon is a hardliner against peace. Why does Barak feel like he needs to consider this coalition with Sharon?
Well, first of all, Sharon would bridle at the notion that he's against peace. He would say that he is against making compromises to Yasser Arafat because he never thought that Yasser Arafat's heart was in it. And I imagine that Mr. Sharon, along with many on the Israeli right, are feeling, along with anxiety, a sense of vindication. But for Barak now, he has a real problem. He's going to be voted out of office in a matter of days unless he puts together a new coalition. Remember, he was trundling along fairly happily by Israeli political standards until about 3 months ago, when he accepted President Clinton's invitation and came up to Camp David and offered to share Jerusalem with the Palestinians. Now, when he went to Camp David, his majority coalition fell apart. His partners deserted him. These were, on the whole, the Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox religious parties in Israel. They were unhappy with the concessions that he was getting ready to make. And they left him at the head of a minority coalition. which would have meant that if he had reached this treaty with Yasser Arafat, he would then have gone back to the public and said, you know, I've lost my majority here in Parliament. They've voted me out of office, but I've signed this peace deal, and I hope you'll now re-elect me with a nice, strong majority, and I'll be able to implement this peace treaty. Well, of course, that fell apart. The irony now is that because he tried so hard to make peace, his coalition fell apart, and to survive in power now, he needs to attract new coalition partners, and the most obvious partner is the Likud, the other large, relatively large party in Israeli politics.
Palestinian leaders have said that if Sharon is in a coalition government, the Palestinians would be unable to negotiate with the Israelis because Sharon is such a hated figure. He led the invasion, the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982, the invasion in which there were massacres in Palestinian refugee camps.
Yeah, Ariel Sharon is definitely not the most beloved Israeli politician in the Arab world. The trouble is that it seems sometimes to me that the Palestinians never told their people that Ariel Sharon wasn't the Israeli prime minister. And I don't think they ever told their people that the man who Israel did elect as prime minister last year was offering to work with them towards statehood. I mean, I think if Ehud Barak had gone up on Temple Mount a month ago and started talking about how dreadful it was that there were these mosques up there, then you might understand why there would be this hysterical reaction. But first of all, it was the leader of the opposition, the party whose policies Israeli voters rejected last year, who went up there. And second of all, he didn't say anything particularly provocative. This visit, even if it upset, angered the Palestinians simply by virtue of Mr. Sharon being Mr. Sharon, need not have sparked all the senseless, stupid killing that we've seen in the last month, and need not have pushed Mr. Barak to the point where he is now trying to keep together a very disillusioned Israeli public, trying to keep his country in some kind of unified mode, and being forced to seek out political support from the people whose overall policies he was opposing.
David Horovitz will be back in the second half of the show. He's the editor of the Israeli news magazine, The Jerusalem Report, and author of the new memoir, A Little Too Close to God. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From BEA, an e-commerce transactions company providing end-to-end solutions for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Delacorte Press Division, publisher of The Colwood Way, a memoir, the new novel from Homer Hickam, author of October Sky. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, more on why the peace process fell apart and what it would take to resume negotiations. We talk with Hanan Ashrawi, a former member of the Palestinian delegation to the peace process, and Uri Sevier, Israel's representative to the secret Oslo peace talks. And we continue our interview with Israeli journalist David Horovitz.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking to Israelis and Palestinians today about the breakdown of the peace process and what it would take to resume negotiations. Let's get back to our interview with David Horovitz, editor of the Israeli news magazine The Jerusalem Report, and author of the new memoir A Little Too Close to God, The Thrills and Panic of a Life in Israel. As someone who favors the peace process, is this very frustrating to you to see political leaders who are not in favor of the peace process poised to assume leadership?
It's very frustrating, but it's not as though I feel that the Israeli electorate has walked away from this process. And in a sense, there's nothing much that Israel can do about this now. I still think that if, these clashes that are continuing on a daily basis involve a great imbalance in the death toll, and I think many people understandably focus on that and draw conclusions from that. But I'm not sure the conclusions they draw are correct, because in every case that I know about, or certainly in almost every case, Israel has responded to attack. And in the one or two cases where it's alleged that individual Israelis have initiated attacks on Palestinians, well, the Israeli authorities have moved to arrest these people. Israel, I am absolutely convinced, has no desire in seeing this violence continue.
You know, the charge that Palestinians and other Arab leaders are leveling at Israel is that it's overreacted in its use of violence, that when people are throwing stones at the military could try a lesser form of retaliation than shooting and shooting to kill. What's your response to that?
Well, I feel that I'm not qualified, since I'm not out there on the front line, to say that this or that incident, surely they could have resolved it without resort to whatever use of force they did use. I think it's fair if you look at the first two Fridays of this violence, that Sharon went to the Haram al-Sharif, the Temple Mount, on the Thursday. The following day, Palestinian rioters on the Temple Mount were met with a fairly strong response by Israeli police, and I think there were seven people killed that day. A week later, in a really desperate effort to ensure that didn't happen again, the Israeli authorities actually abandoned the Temple Mount during Friday prayers. And there were indeed clashes beyond that particular area, but no bloodshed on the Temple Mount itself. And it may be that somewhere between those two types of police deployment, the very strong presence the first Friday and the non-presence the following Friday, maybe if there had been more sensitive policing on that first Friday, some of this bloodshed might have been averted. But I think it's very hard to second-guess people. I would stress, I've heard it being said many, many times in the last few weeks, and I've shared interviews with Palestinian journalists who have said the bullets are only flying one way. That's not the case. The bullets are flying both ways, and there's some very cynical use of young protesters who are incited to go out by the Palestinian media, who are told by the Palestinian media and their leadership that there is no hope, that the Israelis are just relentlessly brutal, who I don't think were ever told that there was an Israeli government that was working towards statehood with them. These people are out there on the street, they're protesting, and from within their ranks are the occasional people firing, and they are what is attracting the gunfire back.
In your book, you write that although it would be comfortable to place all the blame for our woes on the other side, we have often been as pigheaded and racist and proprietary as they are, if not more so. I'm wondering if you can give us an example of what you were talking about there, and also if you think that that kind of Israeli pigheadedness and Israeli racism is responsible in part for the current breakdown of peace.
Well, I have to say that the section you quoted, as in fact the whole book, was in fact written obviously before this particular outbreak of violence. I think in the past Israel has probably missed opportunities to move forward more rapidly. I think when the time finally comes to take a step back from this descent into violence and start trying to understand why it happened, there may be people who feel that the whole process moved too slowly and that there were interruptions that, if they had been avoided, might have meant that people lost less faith and became less disillusioned and perhaps benefited more quickly from the process, and it might have come to fruition more successfully. But I must say, I think that Israel has actually matured in the last few years, matured to the point where when Barak went off to Camp David in the summer, and for the first time, there were taboos broken in those talks that that the Israeli public, I don't think, dreamed would be broken. I mean, it may be that that for Yasser Arafat, the notion of merely having some kind of control in East Jerusalem and merely having some kind of control in the Old City and merely having to settle for something less than full sovereignty on the Temple Mount was not good enough. But I have to tell you, for the Israeli consensus, the Israeli public, the notion that a prime minister would be willing to negotiate a relinquishing of sovereignty in East Jerusalem, some kind of relinquishing of sovereignty in the Old City, well, it was unthinkable until 3 months ago. And yet, Barak went off to Camp David and he put proposals on the table that he probably had no guarantee the Israeli public would ever support. But the Israeli public did not immediately erupt in a hysteria of opposition when he came back from Camp David without a peace treaty, it should be said, without having achieved success, despite having proposed those kinds of compromises. The public did not erupt. So I can't fault the Israeli public at this stage. And like I say, I wouldn't fault them if, thoroughly disillusioned by what has happened now, they are not willing to endorse those kinds of compromises, certainly for the foreseeable future, for the near future.
Well, David Horovitz, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
David Horovitz is the editor of the Israeli news magazine, The Jerusalem Report, and author of the new memoir about life in Israel, A Little Too Close to God. Coming up, we talk with Hanan Ashrawi, former spokesperson of the Palestinian delegation to the peace talks. This is Fresh Air. Yesterday, the House of Representatives overwhelmingly passed a resolution expressing support for Israel and condemning Yasser Arafat and other Palestinian leaders for encouraging the violence ending in the senseless loss of life. Hanan Ashrawi told me she considers this a cynical manipulation of the pain of the Palestinian people for the sake of votes and campaign funds. Ashrawi was the official spokesperson of the Palestinian delegation to the Middle East peace process from 1991 to 93. She now serves on the Palestine National Council and is the founder and secretary general of the Palestinian Initiative for the Promotion of Global Dialogue and Democracy. She's currently visiting the United States. This morning, I asked for her interpretation of why the peace process has fallen apart and why Palestinians are so disillusioned by the way it had been going.
Well, in the first place, I think the Israelis did not make the transition, the sort of qualitative shift in their mindset and mentalities that they have a peace partner and not a people under occupation. The mentality of occupation is one that distorts extremely the sort of view of the other and the mindset of the self, where implicit in the thinking, if not explicit, is a racist paradigm of having an almost God-given gift to enslave a whole nation, to dictate to the other side, to intimidate the other side, to continue with the policies of occupation, even under the guise of the peace process. So we ended up with more settlements being built, more land being confiscated, a state of siege continuing. The closures continued. They were never lifted. So people said, if this is the peace process, what do we need, you know? What is it like when there's war? That's one thing, and the sort of patronizing attitude that we can do whatever we want to you as Palestinians with impunity, without accountability or intervention. So people were saying, what's the use of signing agreements if they're not honored, if they're constantly modified, if the U.S. constantly bails Israel out and allows Israel to wreak havoc with the peace process?
What would it take, do you think, for Palestinians to go back to the negotiating table?
Well, right now we need a real period of taking stock, of assessment. It's not that we're not going back to the negotiating table. Israel has suspended the peace process. And Israel, in a sense, has destroyed its very substance, its very reality. To us, it's not, unlike Israel and the U.S., we're not interested in the process per se. It's not an objective. We're interested in peace. That's our objective. The Americans seem to think that so long as there's a process, everything is fine, and Israel is free to do whatever it wants, provided people talk. But that's not the issue. People may talk for years, say the wrong things, achieve no results, reach no conclusions or agreements. So we need to be able to intervene to change conditions on the ground. It's not just talks.
What's your reaction to the feeling that Yasser Arafat should have done more, should be doing more,
I think they have
to calm things down and stop the violence?
It's a bit, I think they're a bit confused. It's the Israelis who are the occupying power. It's the Israelis who are in control of every aspect of our reality. It's the Israelis who are shooting to kill, who have Apache helicopters and Cobra fighter gunships. And it's the Israelis who use tanks against civilians and who use high-velocity bullets and live ammunition with our children as target practice. That's where you issue orders to an army. You tell the occupation army that should be disciplined and regimented to withdraw, not to continue the siege, not to shoot at children, not to use live ammunition. That's where the violence is coming from. It's not as if we're two separate states, so fighting each other with two armies. You have a besieged civilian population that is made subject to the most ruthless type of military occupation. And then you tell the victims that they have to sit back and die quietly and accept any kind of punitive measure and accept the siege and accept the theft, the outright theft of their land and their freedom, and not to protest, otherwise they'll be called violent.
I think a lot of people are wondering, a lot of Israelis and other people around the world are wondering, why are teenagers, why are children throwing rocks at armed military? It's an act of provocation when you throw rocks
at armed... Act of provocation?
Well, I mean, when you throw rocks at armed military, you can expect them to do something.
Yeah, but your
right?
military is on your land. The military that's on our land is an occupation army. We don't have weapons. We don't have an army. I was part of the earlier Intifada. I was part of the underground leadership. And we came out, and we faced the army. We were entirely unarmed. We were shot at. We were beaten up. We were imprisoned. We were detained. And we face this because it's our land and we want to be free. Very simply, you never call a people who face the army of occupation as being provocative if they resist occupation. Two, the official conventional wisdom of the American media, that's why I'm very happy to be talking to you on NPR, has generally turned around and blamed the victim. And not only that, but gave themselves the right to adopt the Israeli version, narrative, discourse, wholesale, without even critical thinking or distance. And the worst part, the most horrific part, is that they gave themselves the right to rob us of our most common sense of decency and humanity by accusing us of not having any feelings for our children, as though we send our children out. In all places in the world, it's the younger generation that comes out, that speaks out, that resists, that says this is it. This is a popular revolt against oppression, against discrimination, against injustice. We are making ourselves heard. We are facing an armed, the strongest army in the region, the fourth strongest army in the world, entirely unarmed, but saying we want to be free and you let go of us and leave our land. This is basically the message. Freedom, dignity, independence, and the humanization of the Palestinians.
At the latest round of peace talks before things fell apart, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak had, in the last of the Israeli offers, offered to give back more than 90% of the West Bank.
89% actually, the offer.
And that was seen in Israel as an offer that even went beyond what the Israeli public was willing to stand behind. And, mm-hmm. you know, Barak was seen as by Israeli standards, going pretty far in what he was offering. Mm-hmm. And that's where things fell apart.
Yeah.
Why did that have such a negative reaction among Palestinians when in Israel it was seen as, you know, going further than mm-hmm. than was expected?
Well, because, first of all, we went to the peace process to get back 22% of Palestine, that which was occupied in 1967. And because a Palestinian state is an essential requirement for peace, it has to be viable, it has to be democratic, it has to have its own territorial integrity. So here we get Barak going to Camp David, saying, well, we'll give you, and we'll give you in a very patronizing way, about 89% of your land, between 88 to 90%. We will maintain settlements. We will annex three blocks of your land settlement blocks. We will keep Israeli settlers in Palestine. We will keep Jerusalem, but we will give you administrative responsibility. Typical sort of white man's burden decolonization attitude. We know what's good for you. What we're giving you in a condescending manner. And they couldn't understand, and perhaps they're not ready for it. Maybe even Israeli public opinion is not ready. That we have given them a historical opportunity for peace and for legitimacy on the basis of a two-state solution. If they continue to blur the divide, if they continue to want to acquire land, we're not going to disappear as a people.
As a result of the peace process falling apart, Israeli Prime Minister Barak looks like he will either form a coalition government with Ariel Sharon, who is opposed to the peace process, or the Barak government will likely dissolve when the parliament meets again and be replaced by a conservative government that is likely to be opposed to the peace process. How do you feel about the likelihood that there will either be a coalition government with Sharon in it or a conservative government that is anti-peace process? Do you think that that will make things more difficult for your cause?
Of course, it'll make things more difficult for Israel. Barak has already put the peace process on hold. He's already shelling and killing Palestinians. His army is doing this to prove to the right wing that they can be just as hawkish and as bloodthirsty as the right. And this, to me, is extremely painful and ironic, that any government in Israel tries to gain its credentials by killing more Palestinians than the previous government, to show that they have a strong hand, to show that they are powerful militaristic leaders.
So do you think that you're no worse off with a government that was, say, led by Netanyahu, who's opposed to the peace process, or a coalition government with Sharon, than you'd be with Barak's government?
Well, there's one difference. I think the Likud, the right wing, is subject to some kind of international scrutiny. While the Barak and his people have never been held accountable, they have the a priori blessings of the world, as though they can be guilty of no sin and no evil. The right wing is scrutinized more carefully than Barak and his government. They do not have a sort of forgiveness ahead of time for everything that they've done or might do. That's one. But two, of course, in a sense, it will bring out into the open the essential policies of what's been happening on the ground. Of course, it will make peace that much more difficult, but peace has not been easy. And we've paid a very heavy price for this process and for the interim phase. So it means we will be continuing to pay the price as Palestinians. The American Congress, once again, will adopt more resolutions against the Palestinians. Probably administrations will deal with the process and not with reality. And we will be locked into this dance macabre, and I called it, it's a fatal embrace. We must not continue this.
Hanan Ashrawi, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're most welcome. It's my pleasure.
Hanan Ashrawi is the former spokesperson of the Palestinian delegation to the Middle East peace talks. She's the founder of the Palestinian Initiative for the Promotion of Global Dialogue and Democracy. Coming up, Israel's former negotiator with the Palestinians, Uri Sevier. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
We end today's show on the crisis in the Middle East peace process with Uri Sevier. He was the first Israeli official to negotiate with the PLO. He was Israel's representative at the secret peace talks in Oslo that led to the peace agreement and remained Israel's chief negotiator with the Palestinians until 1996. We called him in Israel. He says the peace process can still be saved. I asked him how.
It must be clear to both leaders, but definitely also to Mr. Arafat, that you cannot have a peace process and a consensus within your society at the same time. Arafat, who is much more in the nation-building process than us, must confront his own opposition and say, this is the road I decided to take with my partners, Rabin and Peres. This is the road I'm going to stick to. It may cost us some compromises, but we have a deal that is better than anything that violence can give us, and basically confront a large opposition. And the same is true for Prime Minister Barak. I think that he has to oppose the opposition to peace here, which has unfortunately grown very much, and Mr. Arafat has not helped the situation in his deeds and in his words. And so I see really the rescue is, first of all, in a strategic decision to confront oppositions domestically. The second step, with the halt of the violence also, there needs to be an immediate dialogue. Now, I was always a big believer in direct bilateral negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians. I know that many believe in enlarging now the umbrella and to bring in the United States and Russia and the Security Council and the G7 and what have you. This was a problem with the process in the last 5 years. In contrast to the years where I was involved, where we negotiated directly, we also built trust. And the trust is now lacking, and there's no way that the third side can create that trust. Therefore, the leaders have to meet, negotiators have to meet, security people have to meet, and rescue the security situation for us, avoid terrorism that would be catastrophic in the interests of Iran and others, and negotiate from the point where negotiations have stopped at Camp David. We were not so far from a real historical agreement.
I'm going to ask you this because you helped to negotiate the Oslo Peace Accord. Do you think that the Israelis and the Palestinians have each upheld their part of the bargain?
Look, many of the articles were not implemented. But until a month ago, most of the things that were not upheld were somehow done in agreement. Now, Palestinians will find you 100 to 200 reasons for frustrations and as to why violence broke out. And I'm not judging now these frustrations, although I clearly could tell you what the Israeli frustrations are. I think those who feel frustrated and who are legitimizing violence, even if they understand it, make an historical mistake, because there's no way the Palestinians are going to find the future that I hope for them, that they obviously deserve, which is a future of freedom, of an independent state, of a viable state, unless they're going to convince Israeli public opinion of their intentions. And what they're doing right now is losing credibility by the day. So some may say on the Palestinian side this is unjust, and they may blame us until their face is blue. This won't help. Israel knows how to create nation building against all odds, and neither of us lives in a fair world. And you can either complain about each other or do the wise thing. And the wise thing is to call for the end of violence and to call for negotiations and to understand for the Palestinians that Israel is there to stay, and that only by convincing Israel and Israelis will there be not only a Palestinian state, but also a state that may be different from their neighbors in the Arab world and move, hopefully, towards democracy where frustrations can be expressed in a different way.
Are you saying that you think it's counterproductive to look at the past and to even look at the events that have led to this current crisis, and instead
don't have time for that right now. We can do it later. I tell you, we've all made mistakes, but I think fundamentally there's a much deeper problem. we need in this peace process to put much greater emphasis on what is called today peace building, which is to create much more cooperation between former enemies, to develop social economic policies where the peace dividends don't fall only to the elite and to the rich and to the politicians, but go from the bottom up, so people see that they have something to gain out of peace. And there needs to be a global effort by where there is funding, not just for security and aid, for which you have tens of billions of dollars, but there's no direct funding to peace. And direct funding to peace, to me, means funding of cooperative projects on a very large scale. And only if people feel involved in the peace process will peace be sustainable, and we will not have these violent eruptions, if it's in South Africa, Bosnia, or now in the Middle East.
Are you concerned that your own government might not want to continue peace talks if Barack is voted out of government and a hardliner comes in, or if Barack forms a coalition government with Ariel Sharon?
I'm totally opposed to that coalition government, and I'm today a member of Knesset, and I've announced, together with a political partner of mine, a member of Knesset, Dalia Rabin, the daughter of late Prime Minister Rabin, that we would very probably leave the coalition if the Likud joins, because it really will make the peace process very difficult. And we're obviously taking political risks, but I would like at the same time to see Palestinians who take the similar kind of risks, and we're telling Yasser Arafat to put an end to it and to begin negotiations. Look, at the end of the day, we'll be back at the table with the same proposals, with the same compromise. And what I do hope for, and I'm trying to work for through my own contacts in the Palestinian Authority, is that we'll not have to bury too many dead on both sides. That is almost the only open question. And I also think that there's been too much propaganda war, and everybody now is climbing on trees and accusing each other. So what if I convince you that my case is more right, or if Hanan Ashrawi convinces you that her case is more right? At the end, we should convince each other how to coexist here, because both of us are here to stay, and both of us are who we are and will not change.
Uri Sevier, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Uri Sevier was Israel's representative at the 1993 secret peace talks in Oslo that led to the peace agreement. He spoke to us from Israel. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Monique Nazareth, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, and Joan Tui-Westman, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, and Patty Leswing. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Incorporated's Delacorte Books Division, publisher of Sometimes I Dream in Italian by Rita Cerisi, a new novel by the author of Pink Slip. And from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
There's a new collection of the Kinks recordings. On the next Fresh Air, we'll hear from lead singer and songwriter Ray Davies, and we'll feature an interview with Richard Pryor. His complete recordings are collected in a new box set. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.